This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 20th of January 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 119th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. We've got a gamut-running, widescreen, clean machine of a show for you today. Quick, smart, hop to it. Here is what we've got. We're starting with a legend, one of the key conspirators in late 20th century pop culture, one of the most famous faces to ever strike an attitude in dreads and makeup, or in hats and makeup. Boy George is in the studio to tell us about comebacks, love, and while he'll never be the uncle in the boob tube.
The other night I was in Milan and this woman came up to me and she went, "Do you really want to hurt me?" And I looked at her and I was like, "Yeah, I do actually. Is that your opening line?"
Then we're off to Cologne to meet the artist and designer Rolf Sachs, whose new exhibition explores the stereotypes of Germans. What is typically German, he asks.
I think that is something which is important for the Germans. I think they should have a little lightness to themselves, one has to laugh at but oneself.
And we'll be talking about Norwegian political thriller Mammon, which has just made its way onto the commissioning roster of multiple European broadcasters, including the UK's Channel 4. Is this the next Nordic powerhouse for a subtitle-hungry viewing public?
It's a bit different and it's a bit interesting. It's dark, but equally it's, yeah, as we said, it's not your traditional murder drama.
Plus, with London's Frieze Art Fair employing some quality control in 2013, shedding galleries, we ask if last week's London Art Fair got its day in the sun. That little lot is all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Thanks for lending us your ears, as ever. First, then, to Boy George, a man of many parts. Part pop legend, part international superstar DJ, part troubled soul, it sometimes seems. Many of these parts have been played out in public. Can we say privates on parade? I suppose we just did. Consider this, though. Boy George has had a 30-year career with and without Culture Club. He sold 150 million records and scored top 10 hits in every musical territory. The number ones are famous, but his importance as an icon and an inspiration before global stardom took place might have been underplayed. Why am I telling you all this? Because Boy George's new album, This Is What I Do, is very good. First of all, we'll play you the opening track, King of Everything, and then the chat. He's such a great wit, we let it run. Here he is, Boy George is back.
What's the word on the street? Have I lost my crown? Or will I be king again? What's the word on the street? Have I lost my crown?
George, thank you so much for coming in and joining us on the Culture Show.
Thank you for having me. What a lovely place.
It's all right, isn't it?
Yeah.
This Is What I Do is a new album. There's an honesty to the kind of intent of This Is What I Do, I make records.
And, exactly, yeah.
And your voice on the record sounds amazing.
Oh, thank
I think
you
that's
much.
One of those things that, I mean, as you alluded to there, when people Google Boy George, they get all sorts of different things coming up. People sometimes might have forgotten, certainly since your last studio record in 95, how amazing that voice is. Obviously, you've lent it to collaborations quite famously over the last few years and stuff. But is that one of those things when that pops out of the speakers at you, when you listen back to it in the studio, you think, God, this works?
Well, I don't think you ever feel like that about what you do. You know, it's kind of, you're always a little bit slightly detached from what you do once you've done it. I mean, I did have a moment when we recorded, when we finished King of Everything, which was the first sort of focus track that we put out. I did have a quite emotional moment listening to it. And since then, it hasn't made me feel emotional because I suppose it's now out there in the world. And so I can't feel attached to it. My baby has gone out.
After 18 years, then we said 1995 is the last studio record.
Yeah.
How on earth do you decide what you want to do? How the feel and the vibe of the record is obviously something, and it has a very continuous kind of feeling of it has an easy quality to it, right?
Yeah.
How did you decide on that?
We didn't want to do anything that sounded like me trying to be current. You know, I didn't really want to sound like I was trying to fit into, you know, what's going on now, because it's a bit like your uncle kind of putting on a boob tube and sort of trying to be trying to be all trendy. Let's go partying. I just wanted to sound. I went back actually to all the things that turned me on at sort of 10, 11, yeah. 12, 13. You know, the 70s, I went back to the 70s, which I always do when I'm looking for inspiration or kind of intention, sort of spirit, vibe. And so I went back to all the things, you know, and the 70s was such a bonkers decade for music because you had, you know, glam rock, reggae, you had the Goombe Dance Band and the Sex Pistols, yeah. Cliff Richard, you know, and your disco, you know, it was all these sort of things that shouldn't have gone together. You know, when you watch Top of the Pops in the 70s, you never knew what was going to pop up, you know, Gary Glitter, Mrs. Mills, yeah. You know, it was bonkers. And I was so influenced by all of that, you know, when I was growing up. So whenever I'm sort of looking for inspiration, I'll always go back to those people, the Bowies, you know, Roxy Music, Mark Bolan, Joni Mitchell, Dylan, you know, Leonard Cohen, all of those kind of characters. And plus working with Richie Stevens, you know, the drummer and also the producer of the record, he is Mr. Kind of understated. It's like, no, there's no need for those chords. Okay. You know, he's one of those, pull it back. And so that was great because it's exactly what I wanted, you know, just to sort of not sound like anyone was trying too hard.
It's got that nice thing. It's a lean, mean album. There's not too many songs on it. It's not too long. It's a piece of work, you know?
Yeah.
And is that the thing? Did Richie have to sort of pull you back? Did you come into the studio with 24 songs and he scaled it back? Or you scaled it back together? How did it work?
No, we only had a couple of other songs that we didn't end up using. We spent a lot of time getting the tracks that we wanted. You know, you start off by trying to find two key tracks. Those, for me, were King of Everything and My God, which I wrote with Youth. You know, Killing Joke Youth, Youth Who Produced the Verve. And once I'd got those kind of key tracks, then I kind of knew what I wanted everything else to kind of be. And, you know, Richie is someone that's played with, you know, he's a white reggae drummer, but he's played with Lynton Kwesi Johnson, Horace Andy. He's played with loads of amazing reggae bands, and he's a very good reggae drummer. So originally, the album was all going to be reggae. And then we sort of started doing it and decided that that would be quite restrictive. But we are working right now on a kind of this is what I dub.
Okay, sort of thing, nice.
Which I'm going to hopefully put out around my birthday in June. It's kind of like dub versions of some of the tracks and then a couple of three or four new tunes as well.
It's really nice hearing the reggae back. I mean, obviously that was one of the key parts of Culture Club when you guys first broke out. That was one of the key things. It was, again, this white reggae that no one had heard. Maybe there was a bit of the Police. Maybe we're doing something vaguely similar, a very different style. But that white reggae thing is amazing.
Yeah, I think on these tracks, we've been a bit more authentic. You know, I think with the Culture Club thing, it was a little bit white boy reggae. We've kind of gone for a bit more of a kind of authentic sound with these tracks. But yeah, reggae's always been something that I've loved, you know, since sort of early 70s. That's when I really first heard things like Ken Booth, you know, Johnny Nash, Susan Cadogan, all that kind of really early lovers rock, which is really what first drew me to reggae music.
And that lovers rock is in the soulful voice as well, Susan Cadogan, Marsha Aitken, these kinds of female reggae singers with those amazing voices. Yeah. There's that in this new record of yours, I think, that soul reggae thing.
Yeah, and we also had Dennis Bevel involved, you know, with us as well. So that was just great to have him around, you know, kind of spreading his magic. I don't know if you've ever met Dennis.
No, but I feel like he's walking through the studio with like an incense burner. Not incense.
No, usually with a bag of mangoes, but he's just a force of nature. You know, he's just one of these people that, you know, almost when you're doing reggae records or working on anything in that vibe, if he comes along and kind of just, you know, with his bag of mangoes, you know, you're in the good right area, you know.
I like the idea of that. It sounds like a Rolling Stones rider from the 70s.
I feel like I should write a
bag
song
of mangoes in inverted commas.
I should write a song called Bag of Mangoes.
Please do that. Maybe that's, you said that you responded to a journalist, but and this is how the album had its title, This Is What I Do.
I might write that down,
please,
actually.
Bag of Mangoes.
Bag of Mangoes.
That's the dub LP. Or maybe that's the podcast.
Possibly.
Because you said that really needs some work on the naming front.
I still have that smile.
other than the reggae, there's a lovely cover of the Yoko Ono song, Death of Samantha.
Yeah.
Has that always been a favourite? Have you always wanted to cover that? Because that's, for some people, people will be on the Wikipedia looking that up, loving the song, loving your version of it, but wondering where that came from.
Well, the original is also beautiful. I mean, Yoko's, there's a couple of versions. There's a really great acoustic version that she does that I always play it to people when they say, oh, but Yoko Ono doesn't really sing, she screams, and what does she do? And I say, oh, no, she's a really great songwriter. And then I play him things like New York Woman from Rising or whatever, some of that stuff. Yeah, I just think it's a great song. It's one of those songs I wish I'd written. I remember the first time I heard it, I was like, wow, you know, this is such a beautiful song. And I was really surprised at how good the lyrics were, and then kind of it got me to kind of explore more of Yoko's work. And I don't know, I like Yoko because I think she's always been a kind of, you know, she's always sort of been an outcast a bit, you know. I mean, ridiculous accusations of her
breaking up the Beatles.
I mean, like, I mean, you know, bands break up, you know.
She was the fall guy, wasn't she, for many...
Yeah, but I think she's kind of worn it very well, you know. She's never really, with her, you know, you always know where you are with Yoko. She's always looked the same. There's never been kind of Yoko Light or, you know, Yoko Sugar Free. It's always been Yoko is Yoko. And I love that about her, you know. Yeah. And I've always kind of, I don't know, I've met her a few times over the years, and it's like meeting the Queen, you know.
Yeah.
She's awesome.
Does she give you a bit of a butterfly in the tummy when you meet someone like Yoko Ono?
I just think, you know, I did her Meltdown last year.
Yeah, of course you did,
And, you know, I just was amazed that, you know, she's 82 years old. I remember a couple of years ago, she came and played at Nag Nag Nag, which is this little electro club. And I remember thinking, she's like in her 70s. She doesn't need the money. She's not here for the money. It's like, why is she here at 3 a.m. playing? It's just bonkers. That's kind of what I like about her, you know, her spirit.
I wanted to ask you about the lyrical concerns of the album. It's very honest. Seems like a very honest record. Obviously, as we said, there's a gap, long gap between this and your last record. You take on all the people that maybe would have said, oh, you didn't write about us, perhaps. Or is it more about you? Is it about your newfound kind of strength for this record?
I'm surprised that people were saying it's really honest, because I tried really hard to kind of be a bit third person with the lyrics, but obviously failed miserably.
Nurse the screens, I'm writing a song.
And I don't know, I just felt like I'd tried to kind of write with King of Everything. I was kind of writing about someone else, but of course it's a little bit about me. It's a little bit about anyone, you know. It's about human frailty. It's about people messing up. So I was writing about a kind of boxer guy singing to his wife with his kid, and I thought I'd get away with that, but clearly not, because people was like, oh, you know, it's about you, right? And I'm going, well, I haven't got a baby or a wife, but yeah, it's about me. It's about everybody. It's when you write a song, you start off with maybe a kind of really clear idea about what you want to sing about, and then it kind of goes off on tangents. There's no formula, certainly not for me, you know, and I do get kind of quite cryptic and ethereal, and I kind of throw things in that have got nothing to do with necessarily what I'm singing about. There are some songs like Love and Danger is a kind of very obvious narrative, and things like My God, that's a kind of direct story about something, but generally, sometimes words sound great and you think, well, I'm just going to use that. And sometimes it turns out that it's the right word, you know, it's quite random.
It's the point, suddenly it's got a poignancy to it, right?
Yeah, and I think sometimes what you do with songs is you kind of make sense of them after you've written them. You say, oh, well, this is what it's about, you know, when actually, like a song like Any Road, I was just literally, it was almost like a stream of consciousness, and it kind of makes sense. And then I went back and kind of changed some things. But there is no formula with writing songs, you know.
It's easy when you're the one who stops loving first. Yeah, it's easy when you're the one who stops loving first. Now your big words mean nothing. Your smile is like a curse. Oh, it's easy when you're the one who stops loving first.
Before we go, I wanted to ask you specifically about a song called It's Easy, which sounds, that's a lovely record. It is easy. It's kind of like a, it's got a Nick Lowe vibe to it. It's got a kind of almost a country vibe to it. That's a bit of a departure.
Yeah, I've never been, reggae and country are quite closely linked, surprisingly. I mean, there's a lot of country music in Jamaica. You hear things like Charlie Pride all over the radio, and Jamaicans love country. There is a weird connection. I, you know, And also because, you know, country is pretty camp and reggae can be pretty camp, but then they both seem to be quite unaware of that. You know?
I don't think they...
calling me camp.
Dress like this.
And yeah. I don't know. I think, the song...
Reggae and chaps. There's another...
Exactly. Reggae and chips. I think, you know, I just kind of, when I write a song, you know, I just kind of, I'm really into, obviously, Dylan. And I'm really into Leonard Cohen and Patsy Cline. So there's, I think those three elements are in that song. Yeah. You know, a sort of, you know, I was looking for a kind of, you know, a line, you know, it's easy when you're the one that stops loving first. Once you've got a line like that, the song kind of writes itself.
Yeah.
Because that's really the payoff line. I just wanted to come up with a line like that because it's true, isn't it? I
mean, it's a bit of three cigarettes in the ashtray to that one.
Yeah. I mean, having been the person that, generally, I'm probably better at leaving people these days as I've got older. You know, I get rid of people if they're not working. You know, if they're not working, I don't hang around like I used to. But generally, I've been the one that's sort of like, oh, it's easy for you because you don't love me anymore. Yes. So I write it from a bit of experience.
We had Gregory Portion here, the jazz artist, last week. And he said, he played a live session for us and he was introducing one of his songs. And he goes, this song is about heartbreak, and everyone in the audience was like, oh God, he's such a, what a lovely man he is, you know, that's such a shame. And then he goes, which would have been a shame, but I was nominated for a Grammy for it. And it has to be like that. You have to be like that, right? When you write a song for someone.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I always kind of, I think it's easy. It's also about dignity. It's about like breaking up with someone and not arguing about who's going to take what, you know. I was talking with a friend of mine yesterday who was married to someone famous. I won't say who they were. And I said, oh, they must have got a fortune when they split up. And my friend was like, no, she didn't take a penny. And I was like, actually, good for her. I said, well, how come she's got so much money? Because she's been really good with property. Maybe they'll be wondering who I'm talking about. I'm not going to tell you. But dignity is a good thing, you know. And I think sometimes I admire people who can kind of walk away from relationships and sort of just say, oh, keep the telly. You have the dog. You know, really, I'm fine. Just give me my jewellery. I think, so that's really what the song's about. You know, take the TV, take the dog, take the money. You know, it really, because when there's no love,
yeah,
it doesn't really matter, does it?
No, that TV will always feel like it's got a little bit of a bad picture anyway. You have to keep on whacking
exactly.
It on the side.
And one of the things I did recently was I actually got rid of loads of old kind of letters. I just sort of was going through some old stuff and I was like, why have I got these letters from sort of ex-partners from 20 years ago? I don't need them. Unless I'm going to blackmail them, I might as well just get rid of them.
So when's the right time to read them?
You know, well, I was going from when I was thinking, I can't believe I've kept them this long, you know, and yeah. I kind of shredded them all and it was great. I felt amazing.
One for the diaries, though.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I can't remember any of them now, though. Now is the time.
I've got one more question, actually, which is about you. We were talking about Twitter and all the rest of it. Is taking a break out and coming back with this new studio LP. Obviously, there's all the DJing and all that sort of its own snowball, its own monster now, isn't it?
Yeah.
But is promoting stuff and doing this kind of thing, is that different to how it was 15 years ago and before that? Or is and embracing all the social media and stuff, has that changed your job promoting a record?
Actually, it feels different here. Because I'm doing different things, so I'm not doing everything. I'm sort of saying no to a lot of things. You know, I don't really want to do that, you know. But abroad, places like France, it just feels like they never kind of got over what I was 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting that, like, places like Italy and France, they do tend to kind of be obsessed with the 80s.
Yeah.
And in fact, the other night I was in Milan and this woman came up to me and she went, do you really want to hurt me? And I looked at her and I was like, yeah, I do actually. Is that your opening line? I was like, I've done so much since that record. I mean, I love the record, don't get me wrong, but it's like, you're negating my whole life, you know? And then she just kind of carried on doing what she was doing. But there is a kind of...
What was she doing?
Oh, she was just trying to interview me about the past. You know, it's like, you know, like people say things like, do you miss the 80s? I'm like, no. What kind of sad individual would I be if I missed the 80s? I
mean, that was going to be my last question.
Oh, it was? Oh, yeah, well, I don't. But I think in certain places, you know, because I haven't been to sort of certain countries for a long time, it's like they sort of think, like they say, oh, you look really different. Yeah, I cut my dreadlocks off in there about 1987 or something. And it's just so funny. And it's like, well, yeah, I'm 52.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing what people think and what people say. And I suppose in a way, that's part of the fun of it, you know.
It's kind of one of those nice things. When you've been such a huge part of pop culture, it's a daunting thing to look back on it, maybe. Before this interview started, I was chatting to a friend upstairs and he was saying, tell Boy George that at Aston Villa, there's a chant to Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, which is for one of their strikers, and they sing it in the terraces, and it's the most famous chant this season because this guy, Agbonlahor, he's the top scorer or whatever for Aston Villa. So it's one of those things. It seeps through to everywhere.
Oh, there's a Karma Kamini one, I think, that gets chanted as well, which I love that. I mean, I love that kind of aspect.
That's kind of when you know, it's kind of, number one is one thing, but you kind of know you've made it when people are bastardising the lyrics to your own songs, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And what's the other one? Does your boyfriend know you're here?
Yeah.
I love that too.
I think we've solved every future problem of naming all future records, Boy George, in that conversation. We've got Mangoes.
Does your boyfriend know you're here?
And does your boyfriend know you're here?
Jamaican and chips.
Well, there you have it. That was Boy George. And this is Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Where else to go next? Oh, you know, the state of the German psyche.
Contemporary Czech designers are embracing age-old bohemian glassmaking traditions and mixing in new techniques to create modern products with soul. Monocle Films pays a visit to some of the country's most clear-thinking glass alchemists.
Original decoration, this is very difficult, and it must be about emotions. And if I'm teaching students, I'm speaking about mentality of glassmakers, that it's not good to be proud only. Artists must be humble too.
Clear Vision, Czech Glass. Now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Okay, about whom am I talking? Rigor and organisation, precision with diligence, nostalgia and rootedness, romanticism, the freedom of the Autobahn, the legacy of war, naturism. No prizes for guessing which people and which country I'm describing. Actually, these aren't my adjectives, but those describing Germany of the artist and designer Rolf Sachs, who, with a German father, French mother, and practicing out of London, might be well placed to define the state of the nation. Sachs's new exhibition, Typisch Deutsch, opened last week at Cologne's Mack Museum of Applied Arts, and it's a breezy, witty look at what Sachs sees as German traits. He gave me a tour.
Here we have the first object, which is about bureaucracy. Germany, of course, is a very precise country. Bureaucracy is occasionally perhaps a little much, or at least gets perceived as such. But at the same time, this show should show also why does Germany function so well. And also, one of the ideas why I wanted to do the show is just that I had the feeling, living in London, looking at Germany, how the perception of Germany has changed over the last I would say perhaps decade. And it's already 5 years ago, I felt it in the zeitgeist somehow that things are changing, which is nice. Of course, we had dark clouds, which are understandable and which one should never forget.
So it's maybe like a softening, perhaps, of people's idea of Germany, at least from your London perspective.
Exactly. And one should also look, you know, at Germany has done over the last centuries, where it has probably it's one of the countries which has the most solid educational and philosophical base of probably any culture in Europe. So the whole show, I always try to look at it with a little wit, with humor. Yeah, also going against the cliche perhaps a little bit that the Germans are absolutely humorless. Yeah.
Okay. I think we're starting as we mean to go on, Rolf. Take us downstairs into this, I guess, the main chamber here at Mack.
So this is a piece that expresses romanticism. The romantic movement was something which started at the end of the 18th century in Germany. And I think it was a little counter to the Reformation, where everything was sort of the virtue was work hard and you'll be happy. And so probably German was in a very strict environment. And there are a lot of intellectuals and first also the writers who tried to sort of liberate themselves from that. They became adventurous and with that, of course, extremely poetic, like we know the Romantic today. And here this installation where you see a fountain pen where every 30 seconds a drop comes out. It's sort of quite scientific in its approach. But then once the drop crashes into the water, into the liquid, it becomes very poetic, and each one develops totally individually in its own.
That's a beautiful piece. There's a bit of precision in the romanticism as well there, Rolf, right?
I think the romantic movement probably came out of this precision, yeah? You normally always need a counter movement. And it's like in communism, you know, there's a lot of special art which suddenly came out, and we saw it in the Chinese culture. So you always need this opposite ends which nurture each other. So I would say now we can go upstairs.
Okay.
So this is what we call the German Angst, yeah, which is a sort of, and also a gloomy feeling which sits with the Germans. In the old days, it was very important, you had the Bible, and if you were a sinner, you had, you know, certain angst. There's a little money bag here, there's a time, there's a sponge, there's a Heidegger book. Of course, Heidegger was the philosopher, yeah, who really preoccupied one with the angst, yeah, and the German angst.
How does it work when people are going to walk round and see the stuff? There's a great wry sense of humour to a lot of this stuff and a lot of touching sort of emotion to it as well. Are you interested in what people say when they walk around? Do you want to kind of overhear their comments, or do you want to just make the show and wash your hands of it? How involved can you be after you've put the installation together?
Of course, one is always interested how the public sees it, yeah? And that it touches a nerve, and we already had a sort of private opening 2 days ago. And I think people got it, and people look at themselves, and foreigners look at it, oh yeah, that's probably quite German. And there's, which is quite nice also, I think a lot of the clichés, which one was always a little bit jokingly laughing about the Germans, are today traits which are necessary in our world. One needs to be more precise. Everything is more competitive. One needs to be more punctual. Yeah, one can't take it as easy as one probably used to. So a lot of these things, perhaps where the Germans were a little bit smiled at, today they're admired for.
Well, there's some sharp shooting in here and some precision, but also much more sense of humour, perhaps, than, as you said at the beginning of our tour, than 10 years ago people might have thought. Yeah. Is that something, obviously this is part of your own practice and your own personality very much, that it is not done with a serious face all the time. But is that something that you wanted to positively sort of broadcast in your show?
I think that is something which is important for the Germans. I think they should have a little bit more Leichtigkeit to science, yeah, a little lightness to themselves. One has to laugh about oneself, and one has to take things more easy. It makes life just easier. And I think this is part also what my message is of that show. And I think anyway, all the arts, they want to basically broaden the mind, open the mind, increase tolerance and understanding. And today, especially with all the migrations you have, which is of course a theme in all countries in Europe, I think this is very, very important to be able and have understanding for other cultures and other traits.
That was Rolf Sachs talking me through his new exhibition, Typisch Deutsch, which opened last week at the Mack Gallery in Cologne and runs until the 21st of April. It's not over yet, because we'll be telling you about the latest Nordic Noir, which will be gracing TV sets around the world in the months to come. And has the London Art Fair found a new niche? Now Frieze is scaling back. All will be revealed here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Now for a bit on the content and business of what you, me and everyone we know might be glued to on the TV this year. Some call it Scandram, some call it Nordic Noir. Either way, the Danes and Swedes seem to have a stranglehold on the international drama market, or at least they've had a few strong fingers around the neck of America's stranglehold. Now it seems that it might be Norway's turn to shine and shock in equal measure. Mammon is new from NRK, the Norwegian state broadcaster, and it's just been bought in a flash by UK broadcaster Channel 4. To talk about the show and the significance of its sale, I'm joined by Peter White from Broadcast Magazine.
Mammon is a Norwegian drama. It comes from their local public broadcaster called NRK, which is the equivalent to the BBC. And it's a pretty, pretty exciting show. It's just been picked up in the UK by Channel 4, which is the first time that they've bought into Scandinavian drama, mm-hmm. Scandram, as a lot of people are calling it. it's a little bit different to The Killing and The Bridge and the others. It looks a little bit more like All the President's Men mm-hmm. or State of Play. So it's still quite dark and it's still a thriller, but it's not necessarily the same kind of crime drama that that we're used to in terms of the Nordic noir that we've been watching over here.
Dette handler om veldig, veldig mye mer penger.
Hva er det han skriker?
Andreas!
Mammon, ny serie, starter første nyttårsdag på NRK1.
So it's noir-ish, but it's not about a missing girl or a missing person. It's a bit more of it's a political thing. The lead character is a newspaper reporter,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
An unstinting reporter.
It's written
Which, if it was one of us, who would it be, do you think?
I think we could fight over which one of us is Woodward and which one is Bernstein, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I want to be Robert Redford, so you can be...
oh, okay. I'll be the other guy.
It's written by a journalist about a journalist, and it shares that similarity to State of Play in the sense that he's trying to uncover the truth, but the truth lies with murder, betrayal, and corruption.
And did this start life as a TV show? Was it a novel? What was its sort of genesis?
It was written in Norway as a TV series. I'm going to butcher his name, but Gjermund Stenberg Eriksson wrote it, and it was produced by his brother Vigard. And they were really just kind of interested to do a mini series and get a little bit away from the noir style of shows, and they were keen to do something political, something sort of looking at the sort of financial corruption. So they created the show, and it's the highest rated drama in Norway in many, many years. It launched just at the start of January. So it's done very well there. It's also being remade in the United States. I'm sure they're sort of plotting what they're going to do with it at the moment. Peter Chernin, who was the new core boss of Fox, one of Rupert Murdoch's lieutenants, has bought the rights to remake it. So it's already shopped in a lot of other territories and across Europe. It's a bit different and it's a bit interesting. It's dark, but equally, it's not your traditional murder drama.
It's a shorter, maybe meatier series, isn't it? I think it's a six-parter. Certainly, yeah. What Channel 4 are going to be showing. I presume they're going to be showing the original Norwegian language drama. Mm-hmm. It's six, presumably feature-length episodes. That's kind of different. We've got so used to the kind of 13-part, 24-part drama series, which obviously tie you in and make a very handsome and fairly pricey box set at the end for everyone to buy as well. This seems slightly untrendy, shorter thing.
Yeah, they've been slightly influenced. I mean, if you think of British drama, tends to be in the shorter runs, and it tends to be American shows that are much longer runs. And actually, if you think about it, if one guy is writing it, if you can probably pack a lot more into six, the quality, the creative quality of a show in six episodes is likely to be a bit higher than if you're trying to get the same guy to do 13, where he might drag a storyline out or so. So yeah, it is. They've already commissioned a second series, so it'll be interesting to see. I think that's going to be eight episodes, so I guess you can get your box set of seasons one and two once the first two series launch.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it, for the boss of Channel 4 to be saying that, to be kind of crying out, not necessarily crying out, but certainly with open arms accepting dramas with subtitles. It shows how things have changed, how much Scandram, as we're calling it, has sort of changed the playing field. Things were getting rejected, presumably hands down, because of their subtitles, and now they presumably are attracting, certainly for Channel 4, a commercial broadcaster as well, that hit of wealthy sort of AB1 viewers as well, I guess, right?
Yeah, you can make a lot of money because, as you say, the people who are watching them are the target audience for big advertisers. It's sexy. If you come, if you've got a show from Scandinavia or France or Israel or one of the territories that's quite hot, then, the British broadcasters and the American broadcasters are really keen to hear from people, which, you know, certainly wouldn't have happened a few years ago, which is, you know, great for foreign producers. I mean, the shows have to be good. I think the thing, you know, I've seen the first episode of Mammon and it's great. I think the thing is you can't just shop any old show that has subtitles and see if people are going to be interested. I mean, this is a cut above. This is certainly something a bit more interesting than your average show. And the same for The Returned. The Returned, you know, was better than other shows. And I don't think the fact that it had subtitles or was in another language necessarily. You have to almost be sometimes better to punch through that. Otherwise, people can think, well, we can just put on something that's in English.
Do you see this thing where maybe series two is 8 episodes? Do you see them getting larger as the potential is realised a little more?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what the ratings are for this, because if you look at what the BBC 4 dramas tend to do, the Scandinavian dramas, they tend to do about 1 million. So it'll be interesting to see if this does any more or any less. And with The Return, they, you know, put it on a pretty sizable, you know, sizably on the schedule. So people were, you know, they were getting close to 2 million viewers. And the one bit that they probably don't want me to say is these shows are slightly cheaper, because if you're buying in something, particularly from a country that doesn't necessarily sell shows to the UK, you're getting it at a good rate. You're getting it at a good price, which is cheaper than producing, you know, an original show. The company that's selling it wants you to have it, so they're going to give you a good deal. I mean, historically, the Killing was sold so cheap to BBC Four because they knew that as soon as the BBC had bought it, they could sell it to 170 other places and make their money. It's almost like a lost leader. I'm not suggesting that this is necessarily a lost leader for NRK, but, you know, this is cheaper than if Channel 4 wanted to do their own political thriller.
And just finally, talking about the buying and selling of these shows, where would this one have been picked up? How do these things tend to pass between commissioning editors and production companies?
This is a bit quicker. I don't know the specifics of, but I think Jay Hunt herself did the deal. But this wasn't necessarily pitched at a MIPCOM. It came very much at the end of last year. They would have seen the first sort of English language or sort of subtitled version towards the end of the year, sold by a company called Nordic World. Channel 4 really liked the idea, and they picked it up very quickly because there was a little bit of competition, as you can imagine, from the other places that do this in the UK. So no, this wouldn't have necessarily gone through the beauty parade process that some of the others did. And Channel 4 was very quick to buy it. I mean, we only just started writing about this show, you know, a month or two ago. So it was a very quick deal.
And is the UK a good testbed for these things?
UK is arguably the most important market for television outside of the United States. And it's the one place where foreign producers, foreign broadcasters can see if their material can work. Because America is very risk averse. So the Brits tend to do this stuff. And if they do buy something, then, as I said, these other territories are likely to buy it. I mean, I would be very surprised as if by the end of the year, Mammon wasn't in 100 countries, because once it gets on air in the UK and doesn't totally flop, then other people will say, we need that. So yeah, it's a very important market and, you know, arguably the most important out of the States.
The dulcet and familiar tones of Peter White, senior international reporter at Broadcast. Mammon is currently airing on NRK in Norway. As we heard there, it's also been nabbed by Channel 4 here in the UK. But they're not the only ones who've snapped it up. Over the coming year, we'll be seeing Mammon on TV screens in Holland, Switzerland, Austria, Luxembourg, and even the US, where a remake is being planned by 20th Century Fox Television and Chernin Entertainment. So don't say we didn't warn you. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Back to London to finish the show next is the London Art Fair returning like a phoenix from the flames.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got The Curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Culture. Now in its 26th incarnation, the London Art Fair is the oldest of its kind in the UK. Housed in the Business Design Centre in the north of the city, it features 130 galleries from across the country, plus a few select booths from around the world. And with visitor numbers estimated at 25,000 this year for an event that's little known internationally, it's actually big business for galleries, dealers and collectors. But it's also one of the 20 such events happening in the British capital. And with the advent of Frieze in 2003, the London Art Fair has always been somewhat overshadowed by its shinier, bigger, more international neighbour. Back in October, however, Frieze made a decision to scale back. Fewer galleries exhibited and fewer tickets were made available to the public in a bid for quality over quantity. So is it now time for the London Art Fair to step up and fill the void? Or is the event happy with the niche it's already carved out for itself? Well, this year's event took place last week and we sent Monocle's Jack Phillips down to the fair to take a look for himself.
The next station is Angel.
The doors are open, the artwork is hung, and tickets are at the ready as people pour into the auditorium of the former Royal Agricultural Hall to look at thousands of pieces of artwork, and it's all for sale.
The fair is 26 years old. It's the UK's largest fair for modern British and contemporary art. So we like to think that what we represent and present to our visitors is an overview of the complete art world's ecology. There are so many art fairs now, and indeed collectors' time is short that they want to constantly see something fresh. But I think people also want to know that they're going to come and discover something new.
That was fair director Sarah Monk, who promises that this year's show will be the most exciting addition to date.
We have a number of new galleries, so this year we welcome Whitestone Gallery from Japan. I think it demonstrates that the fair is looking to not only support and welcome collectors that are just starting out, but also those people that are looking to acquire work to add to an existing collection or are buying for a private or public museum.
The Whitestone Gallery from Japan is one of the few international exhibitors. Having shown at fairs in LA, Miami, Hong Kong, Korea, Taipei and Singapore, international sales manager Nato Kakamoto is attempting to entice big European collectors. And the work is expensive. You won't get much change out of £600,000.
We brought Japanese avant-garde artist collective called Gutai, and Kazuo Shiraga, he's a giant, he's painted with his feet. You know, these guys are really, really underrated until recently, but now because of all the hype, mainly in US and Europe as well, the prices are going up like crazy. I used to live in London. I used to live, work for the Bonhams Auctioneer, and I know that London is a key place. We always want to come here.
Other exhibitors are using the fair to showcase a mixture of both established and emerging talent, and new collectors can pick up some works for as little as a few hundred pounds.
Cynthia Corbett, director of the Cynthia Corbett Gallery. My first year was 2006 or 2007, but it's been quite a while and it's been really wonderful. And we use the fair as the start of our exhibition year.
Ewan Mundy of Ewan Mundy Fine Art. We're based in Glasgow and I can't remember when we started, decades ago. So we like it because it's a nice big art fair, gets us out of the rain in Glasgow in January.
Returning exhibitors have noticed a change in the look and the feel compared to last year's fair. Dan Hipkin is from Brighton's Ink D Gallery.
We're a bit maybe dirty around the edges in comparison to some of the other spaces. I know we understand that they have a remit on how to hang, but really I think they would rather us having just a clean line of paintings on the wall. But, we are having fun here. We're trying to push it a little bit, and so some of the work is a bit edgy, but hopefully also the hang is a bit edgy as well.
Also taking a walk around the stands is writer and art critic Francesca Gavin. She believes that this particular fair caters to a certain type of collector.
Before Frieze, the London Art Fair was actually quite a thing. It was the only fair that happened in this city, apart from maybe something like smaller fairs specialising in antiques or affordable art. I think now the fair has it's a very specific audience who perhaps are more intimidated by a lot of fairs like Frieze or Frieze Masters. It's definitely not on that international rota, and you're getting different kind of collectors and clients coming here. So ones who largely have specific relationships with specific galleries, or you're getting people who are curious about beginning collecting or beginning buying artwork, and they kind of want to learn more, and it's very unintimidating.
With so much on offer and so much to see, I asked Gavin for her selection of stands to visit.
I think the Sunday Painter, who's got a joint booth with Gallery Stereo from Poland, and 17, who are a great London gallery, who have a shared booth with Fruta from Italy. And that central section of the project section, I think, is really interesting because those are galleries that really should be showing at places like Sunday and Frieze in October. And they do.
Art Projects, housed on the upper balcony above the main fair, is an area for the more conceptual and experimental galleries. This is where you will find the likes of the Limoncello Gallery and Francesca Gavin's picks, The Sunday Painter and Gallery 17. Gallery director of 17 is Dave Hoyland. Invited to participate in this year's fair, his gallery displays some of the more challenging works on view.
There's some new paintings by a guy called Seishin Kaili. They're like super gestural, they look like photographs of gestural paintings almost. We've got some works by Susan Collis, who like super labour-intensive work ends up just looking like a piece of junk.
With a stimulating array of talks, tours and side projects, alongside the main exhibit stands, the London Art Fair fits nicely into this space in North London, presenting a comprehensive selection of decorative and saleable work. But where does it sit within the larger framework of art fairs? Francesca Gavin.
To me, if you were looking for a stepping stone fair, you'd kind of be wanting work that transitions you into what places like Frieze are writing about, and I don't think this fair necessarily does that, but it's trying. What I like about fairs like this, especially when you're seeing secondary market stuff, is damn, it's lovely being able to see like a really good Victor Pasmore or Richard Hamilton. There's a pop artist up there from the 60s I'd never seen. Having the opportunity to see things like that for me is always enjoyable. And I think the project section definitely is trying to shake that up a little bit and introduce some new names to an audience who wouldn't necessarily know it.
Thanks, Jack. And the London Art Fair has now wrapped up for 2014, but we're back on the international circuit. Art Stage Singapore will be reviewed in next week's show. And that's not all. The Sundance Film Festival and the Eurosonic Music Conference will also be picked over next week. January is alive with industry events, and we've been to all of them. Plenty to look forward to, I hope. For this week, though, that's all we've got time for. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. My producer is Katie Bilboa. Holly Fisher worked her usual magic. And thanks also to the mighty Paul Noble this week, too, the powerhouse behind the scenes. We'll end where we began with a new record from the glorious Boy George. It's called This Is What I Do. And from it, This Is My God. Thanks for tuning in. He said, Jesus loves